Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe Simonetto is with us. We're continuing our conversation from before the break, getting a bit of a religion roundup, dealing with matters papal. I'm given to believe that in the Pope's office, I've never seen it personally, across from his desk, there hangs a very ancient and cherished icon, an ancient painting titled The Mother of God, Kazan, and that the Pope has certain designs for this painting. Their designs much grander than just the painting itself. It serves as a symbol for one of the Pope's greatest aspirations before he ends his tenure as Pope and as he rounds the 25-year mark in the papacy. Uwe Simonetto joins us. Uwe, welcome back. And tell us about what the Pope's hopes are for this painting in his office.
Well, he would like to return this this icon to the Russian Orthodox Church. It originated in Kazan. It may have been a Byzantine painting, but it appeared, quote, miraculously, unquote, in Kazan in the 16th century in the ashes of a burned-down building, and is considered by the Russians as the most cherished icon they have. And the Soviets sold it to an Englishman, and the Englishman then sold it to Americans and Canadians, and it finally wound up in Fatima and in the sort of Marian site in Portugal, and eventually in his private office, in his private apartments in Rome. And, of course, it has been his most cherished plan to reconcile or to heal the rift of the great schism of 1054 between the Eastern and the Western Church, as he calls it. The Church must breathe with both lungs again, the Eastern and the Western. And he has made quite good inroads with the Greeks and the Ukrainians and assorted others. But the Russians, for a number of reasons, have not been playing ball, are actually quite hostile. And so what he intended to do was to fly out to Mongolia, actually, where they've just opened a new cathedral, Roman Catholic Cathedral, and then on the way back, stop over in Kazan, which is about 500 miles east of Moscow, and return this icon to Patriarch Alexei II, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, as a gesture of reconciliation. Whether he's going to do this, given his current state of health, one wonders.
So what are we to watch for with regard to the Pope's health in that regard?
None of my contacts in Rome or in Europe are particularly hopeful that he'll have the strength to travel all that far, but you never know. I mean, this man is full of the most amazing surprises. I wouldn't even be surprised if he came out with another encyclical, because his mind is still functioning extremely well. But certainly, if he can gather the strength to do this, and the Russians make a little gesture, come a couple of inches his way. That is what he would like to do. That would be, in a sense, the crowning of his ecumenical endeavors.
Who is Robert Schumann, and why has the paperwork been started for him on the way to sainthood?
Well, he's Robert Schumann, actually, he'll be beatified probably the year after next. Robert Schumann is an Alsatian. He's from Lorraine. He was the former foreign minister, and then prime minister, and then the president of the European of France, and then the president of the European Parliament. And he was in a German concentration camp, and a very ardent Christian. And already during the war in 1942, he said that it was imperative for both nations to forgive each other and embrace each other. That was, while France was still occupied, and he was in a concentration camp. And he was then, one of the founders, maybe the prime mover, along with Konrad Adenauer in Germany and De Gasperi in Italy and others, but especially Konrad Adenauer, in the first forming the steel and coal union between Germany and France, are the two key industries producing raw materials, also, of course, strategic materials, would have come under, it did come under one authority. This then became, of course, the European Economic Union, and has now, of course, evolved into the European Union as a almost a confederation of European states. For example, I am German, my wife is English, we have almost identical passports, and we are both citizens of our countries as well as the European Union, and can vote at least at local and European elections in each other's countries.
So Robert Schuman is, in a sense, if not really the architect so much, he is the
father of Europe.
The father of the modern United Europe.
He's the father of Europe. That's actually his title officially. And let's not forget, he was this out of a deep, deep Christian commitment to forgiveness.
How do you react as a citizen of the European Union and of your country respectively, Uwe, when you hear of Christians, especially those here in the United States, who sometimes characterize the European Union as part of an apocalyptic plan for the rise of the Antichrist, how Lindsay popularized the idea that it would be the ten-headed beast that comes up out of the sea or something along those lines?
Yeah, well, this is silly, isn't it? I mean, you know, it is sort of reading the Bible upside down. Silly speculation. No, of course, then you could say the United States, suddenly the union of all these states or so. I mean, that is cooking up something that is totally unbiblical.
As someone who's lived on both sides of the unification of Europe, pre and post, what do you see as the greatest benefit of a united Europe?
Well, the greatest benefit of a united Europe, to me personally, I have to say this, is, for example, is the reconciliation between Germany and France after 300 years of enmity. And the fact that now the Germans and the French consider each other on a personal level, each other's best friends, is an absolutely stunning turn of events. Then, of course, there are also political and economic and cultural issues involved here, which we won't have the time to discuss. But the very fact, as a Christian also, that we reconciled, and we reconciled so profoundly that we consider each other now each other's best friends, I find that, especially in connection with the question you asked about Robert Schuman, the most important thing. And I, you know, if you believe in the, if that is your thing, if you beatify people, then I mean, I certainly he's one who would deserve it. I mean, we don't do this in the Lutheran Church, but if I were Roman Catholic, I would find this absolutely appropriate.
Turning to a different part of the country, to a different part of the world, you have written most recently an update to the story of Amnia Lewa. Would you tell us who she is and why? Yes, why is her story important for us to note?
Well, it's I've read today. She is a woman, a young woman, peasant in northern Nigeria, is illiterate. Was married, was divorced after having had four children, and then 2 years after her divorce had a child, and was sentenced to death for adultery, even though, I mean, how that is possible, I don't even see the logic in this. The man involved in this thing denied, even though there were three witnesses, denied that he was and was actually acquitted. She was sentenced to death, to be stoned to death, which is what Amnesty International called the worst form of torture ever. And she presumably would have been stoned to death had not the international community, and here specifically the European Union, which is major watchdog in human rights issues and religious rights issues, but also Human Rights Watch and Freedom House here in the United States and others, really pointed their fingers on it and raised absolute hell about it and sent lawyers down. And so in the end, today, she was acquitted the second time round. Last year, another appeals court had affirmed her conviction. But this year, today, an appeals court, a Sharia religious law appeals court, on technical grounds, acquitted her. Seriously, she's not going to be stoned to death. And this is immensely important, I think, because, first of all, northern Nigeria. Nigeria is one country where this particular form of Islam, this radical Islam, makes huge inroads. We have now found that if you actually hold these radical Muslims' feet to the fire, that they will finally say, ouch, and pull back. But it has to be done. I mean, in the meantime, the world over, even in Malaysia, in Pakistan, and elsewhere, the Sharia law is creeping in and is being reintroduced. And unless we are watching carefully, women will be stoned to death for giving birth out of wedlock, for having a child out of wedlock, while men who are always involved in this activity will be set free. You never hear that. I mean, your local feminists in this country wonder whether you should say waitress or wait person, but they, of course, would never bother for one moment about what's going on in those parts of the world, because that's so nice and far away, it doesn't bother their particular comfort. But it is really something that has to be watched. And I wrote today, where were these imams? Where were these big preachers of Islam in this particular case? Why did they not thunder against this horrendous crime that is being committed in the name of God in their country? And they keep mum. It's only Christians who open their mouths about it. And one has to add Western Muslims. I mean, they are very good at that.
Well, it's very sad to note that this case was turned around only because it garnered international attention.
Right.
One wonders how many cases similar to it escape the attention of the international community and therefore go on without anyone's notice.
Well, right. I mean, the media circus marches on. For example, in that same part of northern Nigeria, a man who got involved in a fight and partially blinded another man will have one of his eyes gorged out because that is what a Sharia court decided. And, of course, nobody's going to watch. So, I mean, so that's going to... Or a homosexual will be stoned to death. I don't see the homosexual community that is so involved with electing bishops here marching over there and saying, stop that. I mean, you don't have that. This is where I find the behavior of interest groups so particularly hypocritical. I mean, what is really rather wonderful is that there are non-governmental organizations that are keeping their fingers on that tap. Like, for example, the French organization Lawyers Without Borders, a marvelous organization, by the way.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're doing our religion roundup. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe is religion editor for United Press International. He is joining us from Washington, D.C. Uwe, again, there is we've talked about this a number of times, but it's a subject that, of course, we need to return to as often as possible. And that is the Muslim world and whether or not Islam as a religion is compatible with democracy flourishing in Iraq or elsewhere in the world. You talk about Harvard's Samuel Huntington and kind of a prescient observation he made some time ago. Tell us about this.
Well, Huntington posited about 10 years ago the notion of an impending or the danger of an impending clash of civilizations. And of course, then the whole academic community in a knee-jerk reaction to it said, no, 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 of course, there's none, we're going to be none of that. Huntington actually just asked the question, I mean, which, and I always thought that discourse starts with a question, but they don't feel that way. But it now is very, very clear that unless we find a way of having a discourse with the Muslims, there's going to be a clash of civilization. And there is a possibility, that is something that I'm writing a series currently, and I've published two installments already, on whether we can see a compatibility between Islam and modernity, in this particular case, modernity being defined by Francis Fukuyama as liberal democracy and capitalism. And the interesting thing is that when you go through these Oriental countries, the Islamic countries, which have changed towards modernity, mainly in the 1950s they were all rural, now they are predominantly urban, and the young generation is indeed increasingly open, desires democracy. But the question is, and it's a theological question for which we don't have the ultimate answer yet, whether it is that does not mean, imply in the long run, a change within the Islamic religion. And that, of course, so far as I can see, is not certain, because Islamic religion is much more rigid than Christianity.
Why is it, in a nutshell, that with the exception of Turkey, all countries dominated by Islam in the world are not democracies?
Well, because they have evaded modernity. Modernity, in that sense, liberal democracy, is something that came out of the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. It evolved from there. Including, of course, the concept of the separation of church and state, or, as we would, Lutherans would rather call it, the doctrine of the two kingdoms, the two realms, which should not be cooked and brewed together, as Luther called it. Whereas Islam has, which had flourished greatly 1,000 years ago, has sunk back into a pre-modern sort of state, and this, of course, no longer works because obviously the airwaves are open to everybody. People do watch CNN and Fox and the BBC and what have you. And there is a great deal of unrest, especially in Iran, where 70% of the members of parliament are reformist-oriented and where the students are very restive. However, there is still a rigid theocratic regime as a superstructure above these republican structures that could evolve into something democratic.
So is there hope from countries like Iran, where there seems to be a flourishing kind of reform-minded movement?
Yes, there should, especially from Iran, there should be some hope because, I mean, this is a highly evolved country, a very intelligent country, an enormously rich tradition in poetry and philosophy and other things, and a tradition that has lasted. And it was an aberration, of course, this fundamentalist regime under Khomeini. So there is some hope. Of course, it can go could wind up the other way, too. It could end up in bloodshed. We simply do not know. One has to be very, very, very careful. There is also an interesting side aspect, which I'd like to research. I know that there is that the number of conversions from Islam to Christianity is rapidly increasing inside Iran, especially among women. Apparently, the regime finds it very, very difficult to get a handle on this, especially since the women wear these chadors, these long flowing robes, and of course they can hide the Bible underneath, and are you going to detect that? So there is a lot of Bible reading going on. I'm told by a pastor friend of mine in Germany, for example, is baptizing quite a number of women refugees from Iran. So that is another side aspect, which in itself may not mean all that much, but it's seen in the context of the upheavals inside, the social upheavals and religious upheavals inside Iran, may be quite an important factor.
So in the case of Iran, as kind of a good example of a Muslim country seeming to be on the cusp of reform,
right,
is it not so much any longer a matter of if reform, but when or of what kind?
Well, that's, you're absolutely right. It is a matter of when and what kind, or reform or revolution or bloodshed. You know, that is another issue. We don't know, especially in Iran. But the Iranians themselves say it is simply a matter of time.
So I guess I'm wondering about maybe my kids or my grandkids, if they look out over the geopolitical map after I'm long gone, might they see more Turkeys, more quote-unquote Western-style Islamic countries that have democracies, republics, things like that, than Saudi Arabia's or Nigeria's, things like that?
Well, they might. I mean, obviously we are all hopeful. It could also end up in chaos. And in Nigeria, of course, since you mentioned that again, this is very important because, well, whilst the Islam is growing there, Christianity is growing even faster, and it's very orthodox Christianity, and it's very solid. So they confront each other there. You don't know how countries like, for example, Algeria and Morocco, which are the closest to Europe, are going to develop. And Turkey, Turkey is not such a given yet, because, for example, while there are, I don't know, thousands of imams, Turkish imams in Germany, no German pastor or priest can exercise his craft in Turkey. The only ones that are there are two officially are consular officials. Actually, that's what their passports say. So Turkey is can also fall back into a sort of pre-secular situation, especially since they have an Islamist party in power at the moment. So it's not certain, but I mean the hope is that with developments in countries like Iran, we may see a shift. And of course, once Iran goes, then of course there'll be a snowballing effect there.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. Open lines after this break.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What does St. Paul mean when he writes to the Colossian Christians, "You have died, and your life is now hid with Christ in God"? What is Paul saying when he says that in Christ all the fullness of the deity dwells in bodily form, and that Christians have come to fullness of life in Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. You can order the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians, 1-800-325-3040.
The Jews, they had a stumbling block. Answers with Ken Ham, author of the revolutionary book on witnessing, Why Won't They Listen? Well, Ken, you're talking about a stumbling block the Jews had to the gospel, right?
Well, correct. Now, before I explain, let me read 1 Corinthians 1, verse 23. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. Paul is explaining here that the message of Christ and the cross was a stumbling block to the Jews. You see, the Jews rejected Jesus Christ as a Messiah. However, the Jews at that time did believe in God the Creator. They also had the law of Moses and understood the meaning of sin as recorded in Genesis. In other words, they had the foundation for the gospel. Now, on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, when Peter preached to the Jews, his main message concerned the fact that they crucified the Son of God. He taught them that Jesus was the Messiah, and thousands were converted. Years ago, our own culture was like the Jews. People understood about the Creator and our sin so they could understand the gospel as the Jews did. But our culture doesn't have this foundation anymore. It's not like the Jews now. Actually, it's more like the Greeks. So before we can preach effectively about the cross, people need to be taught the foundations of the gospel from Genesis.
We have a great witnessing tool on the intriguing topic of dinosaurs right on our website. This free booklet, written by Ken Ham, will answer your questions about the mysteries surrounding dinosaurs. Just go to AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31 when we continue here in about a minute and a half with Issues Etc. It will be an open line. AM 850 KFUO weather, partly cloudy, overnight low of 50. Tomorrow partly sunny, there is a chance of rain, 80 for the high. 68 now in St. Louis. Let's turn towards traffic. Northbound 270 between Olive and Dorset, slow traffic in all the lanes. Then it's crowded in the right lanes from Dorset out to the 70 exits. Southbound 270, right before Manchester Road, there's an accident. The center lane is blocked. Traffic is backed up to Olive. Westbound 40 between Chesterfield Airport and Route K, heavy traffic. Eastbound 70 after St. Charles Rock Road, there is an accident. It has been cleared. It's off to the shoulder, but traffic is backed up to 270. Eastbound 44 between 141 and Merrimack River, stop-and-go traffic. That's due to an earlier accident and the normal volume of slow traffic heading towards the Poplar Street Bridge.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back. The remaining 25 minutes of Issues Etc. open lines. Sunday night on the program, we'll discuss liberal theology. How do you pin down something that's kind of like jello? How do you nail that to the wall? Liberal theology. Everyone has their own working definition. How would you properly define liberal theology and its effect in the church today? Dr. Thomas Oden of Drew University will be our guest live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. If you'd like to post a question or a comment in advance of our conversation with Dr. Oden, feel free to do so at the Issues Etc. forum. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. There's a What's New section. Click on that, and you'll find the Issues Etc. forum, issuesetc.org. Questions on liberal theology in advance of Sunday night's program with Dr. Thomas Oden, live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. It's the last half hour of Open Lines this week. If you have a question that's been brewing in your mind through the course of this week's Issues Etc. on any subject, we've been talking about, oh my goodness, yesterday we spent an hour talking about Willow Creek. I took few calls because the thoughts were percolating and I had to get them out in some sort of coherent form before they all went back down beneath the surface of that quagmire I call a mind. If you'd like to react to something said yesterday about Willow Creek and the pragmatism that leads not only to putting the gospel aside on a regular basis, but also putting other Bible passages aside to the point where a church that claims to be Bible-believing and Bible-based can say, look, in spite of what Scripture says about the women exercising the authority of the pastoral office, we're going to have female pastors. That was yesterday's conversation, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, in connection with that, someone did anonymously email me the What We Believe section from Willow Creek's website, and I'm glad they did that. That's always helpful. I've actually perused that and seen that myself, examined it in some detail. However, the point of yesterday's conversation was not what they have on their website, but what they're handing people when they show up. The seeker, the unchurched, the irreligious. What are they handing them? They're handing them a pamphlet that tells all about how Willow Creek is about people, but very little about Jesus Christ. A very well-produced, very expensive cardstock, multi-page, three-color pamphlet on Willow Creek that simply doesn't get around to talking about the cross. Now, yesterday we talked about the gospel of happiness. Today, a different gospel, the gospel of change. Have you heard anyone in your church say this? This has become a cliche that people, it's not only a cliche, it's become a truism. You know what a truism is? Or sometimes we call them axioms. Do you know what an axiom is? It is something that people say that they consider to be self-evident, self-authenticating. A truth that no longer needs to be questioned. Sometimes we just call it conventional wisdom. Of course, conventional wisdom has a way of turning over on a regular basis. Have you heard anyone ever say this? If a church cannot change, it will eventually die. Or maybe you've heard someone in your church say, if our church doesn't change, we'll die. Or churches that don't change, die. This little creed comes in all different kinds of forms. Perhaps its most extreme form is in the title of a book by John Shelby Spong, the former bishop of Newark in the Episcopal Church USA, who wrote a book that is called Christianity Must Change or Die. I think it's called Why Christianity Must Change or Die. Now, the kind of change that Spong was calling for in that book, maybe you're familiar with it, was a radical kind of change. He thought the idea of God had to go. The notion of Jesus was just fine with him as long as Jesus is understood to be the figment of ancient man's imagination. The idea of Christ, A-okay, as long as it's merely the Christ idea and not the Christ who died, was crucified, and rose again. He was calling for radical change. He believes that Christianity cannot survive unless it gives up on the idea of theism, the idea that there is a God. Now, that's John Shelby Spong. He's got his own kind of gospel of change. That's easy to spot. That's not hard to detect. The error of that is obvious. There is a gospel of change with the same creed, if the church doesn't change, it will die, that is more difficult to spot. Its error is more subtle and less obvious. It's very popular in the church today, this gospel of change. I was perusing the Baptist Press website. They not only have news, but they also have columns. And one of their columns, called First Person, regularly features thinkers and idea people and authors and theologians. This one from the 22nd of September, that was just 3 days ago, was written by none other than Rick Warren, pastor of Saddleback Community Church in Lake Forest, California, and, of course, author of several books, including his latest that seems to be sweeping the nation, The Purpose-Driven Life. This 40 Days of Purpose that we've discussed so often here on Issues, etc., in the last several weeks, is his brainchild. He also is, one might say, an apostle of the gospel of change. I'll share some of his ideas with you in just a moment. He, too, says, if a church cannot change, it will die. My questions for him is, how does he know this, and what does he mean by change? Does he mean the same thing that John Shelby Spong means that I just talked about? Does he mean this? I don't think he means the same thing. He's not so radical. That's why this gospel of change is more subtle and more difficult to detect, but just as dangerous. Let's go to the phones. Wade is calling from his car. Wade, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. I had dropped off for Jeff and you to that purpose-driven church, that book on tape. Did you ever listen to that?
Actually, I just read the purpose-driven church. I read sometime back, so I didn't listen to the tape. No.
Okay, because I gave Jeff that whole book on tape. I thought you might do a show, just take an excerpt of that, because I just found that to be so legalistic. But I wanted you to. I don't have any experience with church growth, so I can't speak about it. I can only say that I wouldn't be interested in it. But could you talk about the stardom of another phenomenon, Lee Strobel, who starts at Willow Creek and now he's over at Saddleback? He seems to get a lot of airtime on the other station. If you could just talk about his stardom, and it just seems to be all decisional regeneration he talks about.
Yeah, this is something that kind of requires we go off in somewhat of a different direction here. Now, he was one of the former ministers at Willow Creek, and yes, I am given to understand that he's now associated with Saddleback, and that's not that big of a change. But you're right in your estimation of this decisional theology or decision theology. Actually, it really runs. This decision theology really is the beating heart. And decision theology, in a nutshell, is the classic Arminian view of conversion, held an error held by countless Christians of different denominational stripes. But the classic error is that God has done his part, now you have to do your part. And your part usually consists in a decision. God's done everything he can do to save you. Pretty much from this point on, he's powerless unless you decide to believe in him as though you had the capacity to do that. But, you know, see how it's an error that doesn't just keep its tendrils to itself. It's not just simply an error of saying, well, I decided to follow Jesus and that's how I got saved. It was my decision. And there's an error, there's a big one right there, which is that somehow you had a part in it. You contributed to your salvation. But the tendrils go out, because in order to believe that, you have to believe that in your unregenerate, unbelieving state, you had the capacity to decide for Jesus, that you were able to do it, which goes to what you believe about original sin and the fallenness of man. It also goes to the issue of, so what Jesus did at the cross wasn't enough? You need to finish it off by making a decision for him? So that's the error of decision theology. Now, not to get too far afield on that, it fits beautifully within the methods of both Willow Creek and Saddleback. Why? Because they both believe that in order to bring someone to that point of decision, you have to practice the seeker-oriented method on them. You have to break down the walls and the barriers and their natural all the red flags that naturally fly up when they encounter any kind of religious talk. So you do as little kind of talking in theological terms as possible. You keep your sermons practical, and eventually when you've broken down all their personal barriers, then you introduce them to Jesus. You mention Jesus a lot along the way, but then you actually share with them what Jesus has done, and you call for them to make a decision. This is, and I'm not making this stuff up, folks, this is the tried and true method of Willow Creek. And it's based in, even though Bill Hybels says he is not an Arminian, that is his theology. Now, I've actually chronicled this in an article I've mentioned several times, and that is The Gospel in the Background. Deborah's calling from her car. Deborah, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Hello, Pastor. Your guest today had mentioned the case of the Nigerian woman who was going to be stoned to death mm-hmm. for having a child out of wedlock. And when I heard about that, I was just horrified, and I thought that their laws are brutal and uncivilized. But during the course of the show, it occurred to me that that also is in the Old Testament, such laws as stoning. And I was wondering if you could offer your opinion on that.
Well, what's your precise question there, then, Deborah?
Well, it's not really a question. I was just wondering what your opinion is, because that just seems unsettling to me now that I'm thinking that also has its roots in Christianity.
All right, now that's an interesting way of phrasing it, and thank you very much. First of all, the story, if you didn't catch it, we were talking with Uwe Simonetto about Amina, a young Nigerian, not actually a young woman. She's actually an old woman. She's been married, had some children. She divorced and then was found to be pregnant 2 years after her divorce. The conclusion of the Sharia court was she's an adulteress. The man with whom she had this child was denied any part in it and was let go. She, on the other hand, because she could obviously not get away with denying a part in it, she had the child, was sentenced to die not just by stoning, but being buried up to her torso in the ground and then being stoned slowly to death, according to Sharia law. Now, the story is that she has been given, her sentence has been commuted by the Sharia court because there was so much international attention to her case, and thank God there was, that her life is spared. It does raise the question, doesn't it, about the Old Testament, where the adulteress is to be stoned, or other people who've committed other crimes to be stoned? How is it that is this some dark mark in the past of Christianity or of Judaism that we should say, oh, well, you know, we disavow. Just as we disavow the Muslims doing it today, we disavow that law in the Old Testament. Well, we can hardly do that consistently, can we? We can certainly disavow the Muslim doing it, but we can't simply say, and we disavow those old primitive ideas of the Old Testament, those backward ideas that would have had a woman stoned for adultery. No, that is very clearly God's will in the Old Testament as a matter of civil law among his people in ancient Israel. Very clearly his will. He does not equivocate on that particular point. He doesn't say, you know, until such as a time as I deem, you know, you advanced enough to understand the finer points of how we deal with adultery, you just stone the adulteress. No. The only way to reconcile this is through the person of Christ. Was it a harsh and brutal law? Absolutely. Was it unthinkable not only in its day, but also today? I think so. Do you think the Israelites were delighted to hear, oh, good, we get to stone the adulteress? That sounds like a great thing. Why did God command such brutal punishment for this sin, this crime, and others? Why did he demand it, require it? And that a failure to do it would have been a further infraction against his will? We cannot answer that question unless we understand what the law of the Old Testament, civil, moral, and ceremonial, was all about. It was not about a perfect form of justice among human beings. That law was all intended to do what the law always has been intended to do, to drive the sinner toward Christ. If this is the penalty that God metes out against adultery and other crimes, then how serious must our sin be in his eyes? If this is how God would deal with this sin and others, and have us deal with them in the Old Testament, then how seriously must he take our offenses against him? So why don't we stone the adulteress today, if it's in the Old Testament? Because we have a New Testament that teaches that the law, indeed all of the Old Testament, has been entirely fulfilled in Jesus Christ. He not only perfectly kept it and never was an adulterer and never lusted in his heart and became an adulterer in his heart by his own standard, but he also took the penalty that was due us. Because Jesus says, you lust in your heart after a woman, or a man for that matter, and you have become an adulterer, and you are guilty and liable before the law of God. But he says, I have come to fulfill the law, not only to keep it, but to bear its penalty that was due us. Why don't we stone the adulterers? Because, in a very real sense, Jesus Christ at the cross took that penalty. He took that stoning. It wasn't with stones, it was with nails and whips, and with the indignation and abandonment of God Almighty, and he fulfilled the law. and he rendered it not only obsolete, but no longer able to accuse us because he bore the brunt of its punishment there at the cross. And now, having been raised from the dead, he's not a new lawgiver to say, okay, now let's go back and find some more reasonable laws for the adulterer. He is the forgiver of sins. To the adulterer, he doesn't say, come over here so we can stone you, or maybe since we're more enlightened, we won't stone you. We'll just look upon you with indignation. No. The woman caught in adultery? Who is there to accuse you? Neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more. He's the forgiver of sins, because he's the one who's paid the price that that law demanded for sin in his own body on the cross. Now that's the gospel. Very different from this gospel of change that, if we have time, I'll get around to talking about. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I think yesterday you had a very indicative call relative to the situation of certainly Christianity and certainly in Lutheran circles that is under a lot of tension. A lady called in who said that she perceived that she was being excommunicated or expelled from her congregation because she wouldn't go along with the 40 days of purpose new measures that were coming about. And that yesterday you had your Russian interviewees on there, and they were saying that lay people of Lutheranism in Russia so valued their Lutheranism that they kept the basic liturgy without any experimentation and recitated the sermons of Martin Luther. I think that contrast of how orthodoxy is appealing in Christianity to other places, but it seems to be on the slippery slope here.
Yeah, exactly. I hadn't put those two together like that, but I'm glad that you pointed that out, Herman. I was talking yesterday with a German become Russian pastor and a Russian layperson about Christianity in Russia. And we spent some time in the first part of the conversation talking about what was it like being a Christian before 1989, before the liberation of those countries, before communism fell. And Roman Heinemann was his name. He, the layperson, he said he remembered his grandparents, his grandfathers being killed because they were Christians. He remembered the way his parents worshipped during the time of communism, and how during that time they had no Bible, they had no hymn books, they had nothing. It was all taken away from them. They worshipped clandestinely. And what did they do? Did they get together as small groups of lay people and experiment? No. He said, what we did was we remembered what we could from the way it was before Christianity had been outlawed, and we stuck to that. And his grandparents handed down written sermons to his parents and his parents to him, and they read these again, and they sang the songs that they could remember having sung in freedom during the time of the czars, when they were free to worship, and they passed them down through 70 years. They did not have the opportunity to engage in a lot of innovation. And when freedom came again in 1989, what did they do? Did they say, now with freedom, we're just going to start making it up on our own and reinventing the wheel? Are we going to believe the gospel of change that says the church must change or die? You know, they could have. Those Russian Christians could have said, you know, if the Westerners are telling us that the church has to change or die, they didn't. They went back into the archives. Pastor Spieth told us about it. They went back into the archives. They found those records that had not been destroyed by the communists of how Christians in Russia worshipped before the time of communism. They revived them. They made small necessary changes to what was there. They picked up the old ways of worship, the same old gospel, the same old message of the cross, the same sacraments. Now, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they believe the gospel of change, that if the church didn't change, it would die? Maybe it's because they understood something, having lived literally hand to mouth as a church for 70 years, without pastors, without Bibles, without hymn books, without anything. gathering furtively in their own homes, not unlike Christians during times of earlier persecution. Maybe they learned that there are things worth keeping, things that so clearly communicate the gospel. Maybe they learned that the church doesn't need to change to remain alive. What keeps the church alive is the only thing that doesn't change, the message of the gospel. The church doesn't have to depend on the feeble life support of constant change to thrive and live and continue. That's the gospel of change. The gospel of Jesus Christ, on the other hand, is from the one who says, I do not change. I keep my promises. The word of God remains firm and unmoved. We could learn. You know, we're being told nowadays that we could learn a lot from the most affluent, the richest, the most successful churches in the country. The ones who have found ways to market and grow through the business model, and who are unapologetic about telling us that that's how they grow. They grow through good marketing, good business practice, and technology. They don't even make any bones about it. Not even a mention of the gospel growing the church. We're being told today that that's what we ought to be looking to, that we could learn a lot from these successful, affluent, well-heeled, well-attended churches that seem to have all the answers and are more than happy to provide them to us for the cost of their books or their seminars or their tapes. Maybe, on the other hand, those from whom we have a lot to learn are like the Christians we had on the program yesterday. Christian men who have known what it is to be a Christian when it's illegal to be a Christian, known what it means to confess Christ when it is illegal to confess Christ, known what it is to survive when there is no Bible, when there is no hymnal, when there is nothing except what your parents have taught you and passed down to you, who have known how precious it is that the Word of God does not change and that the church does not survive on change, but on that which God gives us that never changes. It survives upon the enduring Word of God, His Word of law and of gospel. That gospel is the life of the church. Change isn't the life of the church. In many ways, it threatens the life of the church probably more. If they would have adopted the gospel of change, who knows what they would be today. But who are they today, having learned the value of things that endure? Even communism. They're confessing Christians. Are their churches big? No. Are they affluent? No. Are they successful by our standards? No. But those who hear the gospel that they are preaching, the unchanging word of Christ crucified, they're going to heaven. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians.